Good morning. It's such a joy for me this morning to introduce my dear friend Vashti Wilson, as she is back with us to share her heart and words of wisdom as she reflects on Bishop Love's chapter 7, Leave No One Behind. Last year, she gave us a powerful look into her world as a woman of color, a veteran, an entrepreneur, a single mother of a beautiful daughter, and all the challenges of navigating her way in a small town of Solvang, where most people don't look like her. She's been an inspiration to so many of us as she guides us into a deeper awareness of our cultural challenges and our unconscious racial biases. She's truly been a gift to my life as well as our community. This quote by Howard Thurman encapsulates the powerful spirit of our friend Vashti. Don't ask yourself what the world needs. Ask yourself what makes you come alive, and go do that, because what the world needs is people who have come alive. And it's with this spirit of aliveness that Vashti has encouraged her 9-year-old daughter, Maddie, to give back to the world and offer a way for children of all cultures to feel included through Maddie's treasure box. Together, mother and daughter are realizing a mission to provide multicultural books and crayons to promote literacy and inclusion to schools and libraries across America in order to ensure all children are able to see themselves represented. So it's with great pleasure that I give you Vashti Wilson.
Thank you, Dr. Marianne, for inviting me once again. And I was really looking forward to this presentation. Today, I had such a wonderful time speaking with you, conversing with you all last time, and I felt like we were able to learn a lot from each other. So I hope that that aim is fulfilled again today. I'd like to start off by saying that I'm a person who is very direct, and I believe that communication, honest communication, is vital for us to be able to understand and learn from one another. So there is no question that is off limits. If there's something that you feel you'd like me to expound upon, or maybe that you feel that you're coming from a different perspective, it does not offend me whatsoever. I take no offense to anyone else's attitudes, beliefs, or opinions about whatever the topic is. And I hope you don't take offense to mine. When I come to you from a perspective of giving you an insight to maybe an experience or a view of a situation that might not otherwise have been given to you. To touch a little bit on my background, I was a cryptologic linguist for the Air Force. My language was Russian. I am a combat veteran, so I was also in Afghanistan, and I helped to set up Bagram Airfield, which is a short distance away from Kandahar and Kabul, if you heard of everything that's going on. I've also traveled extensively around the world, and I've worked with a lot of startup ventures and people from different countries to help them not only assimilate, but start a conversation depending on where they are. So if that may be a corporation or a business idea or a community, that's the role that I've played essentially most of my life. So the reason why I'm good at that is I serve as kind of a conduit, I think. I'm usually able to see both sides. And for that reason, I take great pride and I value that relationship, that symbiotic relationship. So I believe that love, community, communication, understanding, and a willingness to listen is vital for that to be successful. In this chapter, it talked about your neighbor and what that looks like. And when I started to read the chapter and I sat with what a neighbor, what that feeling would be akin to. And so I want this snippet to be played. If you could play the intro, please, for the video for Mr. Rogers. Thank you.
Hi. It's a beautiful day in this neighborhood, a beautiful day for a neighbor. Would you be mine? Could you be mine? It's a neighborly day in this beauty wood, a neighborly day for a beauty. Would you be mine? Could you be mine? I have always wanted to have a neighbor just like you. I've always wanted to live in a neighborhood with you. So let's make the most of this beautiful day. Since we're together, we might as well say, would you be mine? Could you be mine? Won't you be my neighbor? Won't you please? Won't you please? Please, won't you be my neighbor? Hi, television neighbor.
So I wanted to introduce Mr. Rogers because I was born in 84 and Mr. Rogers first came out in 1969. At that time, what was going on is Blacks were not allowed in public pools. Later on, I'll talk about the fact that he introduced a character called Officer Clemens, which was a big to-do at that time. But when I thought about the neighbor and my daughter, Madison, who has Maddie's Treasure Box, she has a television show now. And the intro to the television show is a homage to Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. Because for so many of us, Black, white, Hispanic, Asian, when you hear Mr. Rogers, most people instantly smile. Because no matter who you are, you felt that you were part of Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. That when you looked at the characters on the show, they weren't all looking like one type of person. That when you, Mr. Rogers spoke to you, and I felt like he was personally speaking to me. I mean, I know he was speaking to a lot of kids, but I felt like I was his favorite. And I felt like I could go to Mr. Rogers' house and Mr. Rogers would be happy to see me. And Mr. Rogers would listen to me, but also see me not only as Vashti, but see me as a person, not as a Black woman, not as a Black kid, or but just see me. And so when I thought about this chapter, I said, one of the things that occurs when you're looking at even in Afghanistan and the prison there, the Abu Dhabi that happened some years ago where they were torturing prisoners, different things that have happened in the US. The reason why you're able to do that is you can treat someone as a it when you don't see them as a thou, right? And what they talked about in this chapter, that before I can see the humanity in you, I have to see you. I have to see you as a being, as a person. And when I think of if I can have the picture that says smile on it come up. One of my master's degrees is from Ole Miss. And one of the deans there was a personal mentor of mine and asked me to help him on this project for the anniversary of the integration of Ole Miss. And so I had to go through all of these images and texts and communications. And it got so bad that I had to stop working on the project because I could not understand how in my mind people could be so inhumane. And one of the images that I remember sticking out to me was this particular image, and it's a man and he is dead. You can see he has his wrists are tied. He's hanging from a tree. But what stood out for me was the fact that this little girl was standing there and she was smiling. And understanding that this little girl is probably my grandparents' age right now. So we're not talking about five generations ago, six generations ago, four generations, we're not even talking about three. We're talking about 1 to 2 generations ago, my mother's time, that this picture was took because my mother was born in the 60s and this picture was taken then. So one generation ago, my mom is in her 50s now, that a man could be hanging from a tree, which I find to be such a grotesque act. And yet we can have someone standing there smiling. And this is not an anomaly. There are many photos like this. And so when I was thinking about this chapter and it invoked the Holocaust, and he talked about really how he could not see this woman as a being, he could not relate to her until he saw the tattoo that she had. And then there was a visceral reaction because at that point she had become real to him. And so when I see images like this, for me, it's a visceral reaction because my family is from Mississippi. I've heard stories like this. If we could pull up the diner photo, please. So again, we're looking at this photo, and the age of this photo means that some of these people may have been your counterparts, right? So again, we're not talking about 100 years ago. We're talking about when you were teenagers, that this was going on, and that this is alive and well for many people that are still living today, or the attitudes that were passed down are still alive and well for many people living today. I'm going to play a clip for you. It's called How Can We Win, I think it is. While this clip is playing, what I want you to do is I want you to take stock of your initial reaction. I want you to take stock of what you were thinking without criticism, without, you know, just merely observing your thoughts. When you see her, when you hear her, what you're feeling, what you're thinking, what you're seeing, and then we'll discuss.
And Vashti, do you want me to play the entire clip or only to a certain point?
I want you to play it until approximately 6, please. So it's about a 6-minute clip.
Okay, will do.
Thank you.
So I've been seeing a lot of things talking of the people making commentary. Interestingly enough, the ones I've noticed that have been making the commentary are wealthy Black people making the commentary about we should not be rioting, we should not be looting, we should not be tearing up our own communities. And then there's been an argument of the other side of we should be hitting them in the pocket. We should be focusing on the blackout days where we don't spend money. But, you know, I feel like we should do both. And I feel like I support both. And I'll tell you why I support both. I support both because there, when you have a civil unrest like this, there are three types of people in the street. There are the protesters, there are the rioters, and there are the looters. The protesters are there because they actually care about what is happening in the community. They want to raise their voices, and they are there strictly to protest. You have the rioters who are angry, who are anarchists, who really just want to fuck shit up, and that's what they're going to do regardless. And then you have the looters. And the looters almost exclusively are just there to do that, to loot. Now, people are like, well, what did you gain? Well, what did you get from looting? I think that as long as we're focusing on the what, we're not focusing on the why, and that's my issue with that. As long as we're focusing on what they're doing, we're not focusing on why they're doing. And some people are like, well, those aren't people who are legitimately angry about what's happening. Those are people who just want to get stuff. Okay, well then, let's go with that. Let's say that's what it is. Let's ask ourselves why in this country in 2020, the financial gap between poor Blacks and the rest of the world is at such a distance that people feel like their only hope and only opportunity to get some of the things that we flaunt and flash in front of them all the time is to walk through a broken glass window and get it. That they are so hopeless that getting that necklace, getting that TV, getting that change, getting that bed, getting that phone, whatever it is that they're gonna get is that in that moment when the riots happen and if they present an opportunity of looting, that's their only opportunity to get it. We need to be questioning that why. Why are people that poor? Why are people that broke? Why are people that food insecure, that clothing insecure, that they feel like their only shot, that they are shooting their shot by walking through a broken glass window to get what they need? And then people want to talk about, well, there's plenty of people who pulled themselves up by their bootstraps and got it on their own. Why can't they do that? Let me explain to you something about economics in America. And I'm so glad that as a child, I got an opportunity to spend time at PUSH where they taught me this, is that we must never forget that economics was the reason that Black people were brought to this country. We came to do the agricultural work in the South and the textile work in the North. Do you understand that? That's what we came to do. We came to do the agricultural work in the South and the textile work in the North. Now, if I right now decided that I wanted to play Monopoly with you, and for 400 rounds of playing Monopoly, I didn't allow you to have any money, I didn't allow you to have anything on the board, I didn't allow for you to have anything. And then we played another 50 rounds of Monopoly, and everything that you gained and you earned while you were playing that round of Monopoly was taken from you. That was Tulsa, that was Rosewood. Those are places where we built Black economic wealth, where we were self-sufficient, where we owned our stores, where we owned our property. and they burned them to the ground. So that's 450 years. So for 400 rounds of Monopoly, you don't get to play at all. Not only do you not get to play, you have to play on the behalf of the person that you're playing against. You have to play and make money and earn wealth for them, and then you have to turn it over to them. So then for 50 years, you finally get a little bit and you're allowed to play. And every time that they don't like the way that you're playing, or that you're catching up, or that you're doing something to be self-sufficient, they burn your game. They burn your cards. They burn your Monopoly money. And then finally at the release and the onset of that, they allow you to play and they say, okay, now you catch up. Now at this point, the only way you're gonna catch up in the game is if the person shares the wealth, correct? But what if every time you share the wealth, then there's psychological warfare against you to say, oh, you're an equal opportunity higher. So if I played 400 rounds of Monopoly with you and I had to play and give you every dime that I made, and then for 50 years, every time that I played, if you didn't like what I did, you got to burn it like they did in Tulsa and like they did in Rosewood. How can you win? How can you win? You can't win. The game is fixed. So when they say, why do you burn down the community? Why do you burn down your own neighborhood? It's not ours. We don't own anything. We don't own anything.
Okay, thank you.
Trevor Noah said it so beautifully last night.
So why did I want this video played? And I want you to, again, take stock of your reactions. This video had been sent to me many times last year, and it took me a while to watch it. And the reason why it took me a while to watch it is because when I saw the video clip, I looked at her and I assumed certain things. I assumed that there was an ignorance there. I assumed that what she was saying would be of no value, that I could not relate. I assumed that what she said was not meaningful enough for me to hear her or to hear the pain within her. And so it took a while for me to see it. And once I did, it took about a third of the video of the way through for me to even see beyond the physical to hear what she was saying and to feel the pain of what she was saying. And I brought such a video because I wanted you to take stock of your visceral reaction. At what point, if any, did she become a thou for you? Many people that I play this video for, when I take initial reactions, they said she was cursing. She was loud. She was ghetto. She was this, she was that. I said, but did you see the pain? Did you hear the voice? Did you see the person behind all of that? Because I imagine that so many of us put others in cages and boxes. And because we do that, whether it's Republican or Democrat, male or female, American, non-American, we are able to silence their voices and silence their pain. We are able to lock them up and put it away, to be able to put them on a tree, to be able to leave a country without thinking about the pain that that's caused them, to be able to see systemic racism, implicit bias, and not say a word, because we have silenced their voices for not appearing as we think they should. Will you play the clip from them and play that until 58 seconds, please? Thank you.
Here we go.
Pretty nice, huh?
Bigger than it looked in the pictures.
When I think of home, I think of a place where there's love overflowing.
You couldn't imagine a nicer place to live.
I wish I was home. I wish I was back there with the things I've been knowing.
This home is ours.
This is how it begins,
with one family.
They came from someplace worse. We'll have to make this place worse.
So I'm showing you these clips because you have to have a perspective, right? Before we get to the neighbor. How can we be neighborly unless we understand where somebody's coming from? My adoptive parents are Jewish. And so there are many traditions that I'm a part of and that my daughter is a part of. But I spent many years studying the Holocaust to understand what they as a people have endured. So that when I speak to them or we celebrate certain things, I have an understanding of why we celebrate that. One of the biggest things that I see in America is the desire to silence the pain, because the pain at times is inconceivable. It's difficult, it's ugly. It's like crust and pus and nobody wants to deal with that. You just want to put a Band-Aid on there. But if you don't understand the pain, then we cannot truly act as neighbors, because then you want to silence my voice. And is that a neighborly reaction, or is that one in which you want your comfort to supersede my being okay? When I think of Mr. Rogers in 1969, if you could bring up the picture of him with, it's labeled 1969. This is a year after the assassination of Martin Luther King. Again, I was saying that the swimming pools were segregated. Mr. Rogers on his own decided to have this Black man on to come on as a new character called Officer Clemens. Now, not only did that present a Black man in a role of being a police officer, which was unheard of and an authority figure, but you also see the symbolism of them washing their feet in this pool. That without word, what Mr. Rogers was making a statement of was the ugliness of what they were doing with the pools, and that he was taking a stand in his own way. He did it without anger. He did it without the need for everyone to understand. He did it simply because he felt that it was the right thing to do. And he saw Officer Clemens as a fellow human being. Now for Officer Clemens, what do you think that did for him? To sit next to this white man in 1969, to wash their feet together, to be in this officer's uniform, to be on a national broadcast representing a police officer, an authority figure at a time when he couldn't even go to the public swimming pool. There's another picture from 1992 in which they came back.
You know, Vashti, one of the pictures you sent did not load. It might be that one.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's fine. And so there's a clip, and I may send it to you afterwards. It's on there. But Officer Clements talks about what that meant for him, that Mr. Rogers had him on. And Mr. Rogers didn't instruct him on how he was supposed to act. He didn't instruct him on how he was supposed to be. Mr. Rogers simply wanted to make a friend and came to him and asked him to be on the show. And he was on there for over 10 years. If you bring up the picture of the candy photo, it's one of my favorites. What's happening in that photo is they were at a funeral and George Bush passed Michelle a piece of candy, which she said had lint on it and was old and the worst candy she ever tasted, but that they had developed this friendship that crossed all kinds of boundaries, not boundaries, but that crossed lines for them. Black woman, white man, Republican, Democrat, it didn't matter. You can see in that photo with her smile and his holding her hand, the affection that they had for one another, the genuine warmth. I also love the other photo, which she is hugging him from behind. I think it's Neighbors, right next on the right. Yep, there you go. That photo right there, his closing of the eyes, her arms around him. This is what Neighbors means to me when I see it. And so when it comes to my living in the San Ynez Valley, when I live in Solvang, I've been in all kinds of situations. Often I'm asked to verify my credentials. I'm asked to be the speaker for all Black people, which I could never be, right? But one of the beautiful things about living here is that because there are people who have made the decision to be truly neighborly and that they do not silence my voice, they allow me to share my pain, but they also support and the progression of us being something different. My daughter can ride her scooter in downtown Solvang, which she does often. And I get phone calls from store owners saying Madison just stopped by and they'll give her a piece of candy. Or if she goes to the pizza shop, they've given her a special gift card that they've loaded so she could go there and get her special pizza. And she has the freedom to do that because people have made a decision that what was in the past will no longer be our future. So when I'm speaking with you today, the question is, what does your neighborhood look like figuratively? What kind of neighbor are you? Are you someone that peeks out in the blinds? Are you someone that's like looking to see if they cut their yard correctly? If they're speaking too loud, if their music is too loud, are you somebody who's like, let me make a plate of cookies and take it over there and get to know them and accept them as they come? Because I think one of the most beautiful things is to exist in a community in which we all come bearing our gifts with our experiences and our cultures and our ideas and our differences. And we do it in a way in which we honor that in each other and give room for that, those differences to enrich our lives. So that is the mandate that I have on my life. And I hope I uphold it. I don't know, Dr. Marianne, if I do. But one of the things I do not shy away from is presenting the pain so that there's understanding of my experiences and my insight, but also presenting the beauty of what it can be when it's transformed into something that's a community. I think that's pretty much what I have to present to you today.